from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you happen to be listening to the show. Happy 4th of July. This is a pre-recorded show for this episode only. So if something happens mid-afternoon on July 4th and Donald Trump blows up half the world and we don't happen to be mentioning it, that's why, because it hasn't happened yet. So anyway, that's our show today. We wanted to get this out to you, and you can listen to it for your listening convenience anytime in the afternoon on July 4th, and obviously at 7 p.m. at our regular time. The show is sitting here waiting eagerly for your ears. Today we're going to be talking about some of the events of the week, and actually kind of a little bit of a roundup of the last month, because the Stonewall 50th anniversary celebrations kind of wound down. They did, at least in the major venues. They were very big, and we're going to talk about how big and what all happened around that. And, of course, controversies, because we always have controversies, otherwise known as drama. And there was definitely some of that. And we're going to talk about what is happening at the Supreme Court. While the cases that they are considering under the Title VII are making the rounds there, and they have been inundated by almost an unprecedented amount of amicus briefs with people weighing in on those cases and the importance of the rights of LGBT people to be upheld and not overturned or not damaged by a potential Supreme Court ruling. We're also going to talk about Donald Trump, what that person is up to these days, and today, in fact. But also, he is launching a new, quote-unquote, and I'm doing major air quotes, human rights panel. There are large concerns as to exactly what the nature of this, quote-unquote, human rights panel will be, in that it is probably not based on the premise of really providing true human rights, rather than putting forth a almost religious agenda. So with that, I will bring on my co-host and friend, Brody Levesque. Good day, Brody.
Good afternoon. Yeah, good day. Thank you. Happy 4th to you. I guess I should note for our listeners in Southern California, yes, that was an earthquake. Yes, it was 6.6 on the Richter scale. It was up near Sears Valley in San Bernardino. A lot of people felt it as far away as San Diego, out in the Imperial Valley, out towards the Coachella Valley, and, of course, all over Los Angeles. So that was an entertaining way to start the 4th of July off in Southern California. So I'm sure that we'll get a presidential tweet accusing, you know, California once again of trying to steal his thunder on his 4th of July by staging an earthquake, and you know how that goes. Anyway, so yeah, we start the afternoon off with that. It's like, okay, fine.
Well, I am curious. Do you have any sense of how many people are supposed to be descending upon Washington for the ridiculous show that he is putting on?
Well, actually, no, we don't. The White House has been touting it as a really big deal. And, of course, the president's been all about, you know, the military flyover and the tanks and the salute to America and the huge fireworks displays. Generally, Washington traditionally on the 4th of July empties out. And the crowds are either a limited amount of tourists and, of course, the locals. And that, you know, and it's always been a very nonpartisan, and I've done all sorts of 4th of July's in Washington over the years, especially when I lived there. And the crowds usually average on a good year upwards of a couple hundred thousand people. You know, and again, the weather will have a big impact on it. Right now in D.C., it's extremely hot, very muggy, and apparently there is a threat of a line of thunderstorms that could actually disrupt the proceedings this evening. So, you know, one can only hope. But the crowd size averages about probably close to 130,000 every year. So it'll be interesting to see if that many people show up. Now, in addition to Trump and his nonsense, unfortunately, the more radicalized Trump supporters, including the racist white supremacist crowd and the Proud Boys, for example, will be in Washington. I get the impression from talking to my friends in the greater D.C. area that most of them are not going to be wandering down this year just because it could be extremely unpleasant. And it really is a and I have to say this, I mean, I have attended over the last 40 years many, many, many 4th of July's on the Mall. And this is not typical. This is very much a political rally. As a matter of fact, NBC News reported yesterday that the Republican National Committee had handed out all these tickets for major GOP donors and party muckety-mucks and blah, blah, blah. NBC checked with the Democratic National Committee and Democratic members of Congress, and they hadn't gotten anything at all. So this is pretty much what one of my colleagues said in a tweet, rather cynically, kind of a Nuremberg-style rally for Trump's people, which that's kind of a hideous, you know, comparison. But when you consider what's going on with the concentration camps on the border, the tanks, the threat of a possible war with Iran, it's not that far off, you know.
No, so that is the image. Yeah, that is the image that is kind of being put out there. So let's contrast that with what happened in New York City over the weekend past, where I believe it's up to 5 million people descended upon New York City for LGBTQ Pride. Stonewall celebration?
Virtually everyone I spoke to, first of all, the event was extremely well attended, and we're talking from all over the globe, the who's who and the movers and shakers of the LGBTQ movement over the last 50 years were there, people whose lives have been impacted by the movement. My friends Dennis and Judy Shepherd were there with the Matthew Shepherd Foundation staff in its entirety. There were activists from the very first Christopher Street Parade, which was organized by the Gay Liberation Front, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha Johnson, and that crew, and they marched. There were representatives of the Peel Regional Police, which is from my hometown of Toronto in Ontario. It was just a really huge, you know, kind of a cross-section of the LGBTQI community. Now, that said, it had a couple of moments that, you know, got a little dicey. There was an interruption at the Stonewall Inn. They were doing a reading, and a black trans woman of color, an activist, interrupted it. And, you know, that didn't go over too well with the predominantly white gay male pride, you know, people sitting around there. Although they were a lot more polite than I thought they were probably going to be in that. There were two parades, actually, and I've got to note this. There was the big one, the Whopper, and then there was a smaller parade that was made up of a lot of activists who aren't really thrilled to death with the presence of corporations at Pride. And they set up what they called the Reclaim Pride parade, which was actually fairly well attended. As a matter of fact, friends of the show, Charles Chan Massey and his husband Joe from the Personal Stories Project participated in that one. Randy Wicker, who's one of the Stonewall veterans, and I know Randy personally, also was there. So that was kind of a contrast to the, I guess you could say, the larger parade. And I think it was just to remind people, as I've seen on the T-shirts, which I think are great, Stonewall was a riot, literally. So,
right.
Pride is supposed to be two parts.
What was the point that the transgender activist at Stonewall was trying to make?
She was making a valid point, Rob. I'm not going to dispute it. There is a marginalization within the gay movement, the gay rights movement, even to this day, of trans women of color in particular, trans folk in general, but mostly trans women of color. And one of the reasons is that an overwhelming percentage of them come from really rough and tumble backgrounds. Many of them are still sex workers or have been sex workers. They're coming from already economically and family disadvantaged conditions, which are pretty rough. And, they feel as though the greater, what I've long referred to as Gay Incorporated, doesn't put a good face on their struggles and what they're doing. And I've got to be perfectly honest with you. I agree with them. I think that there is a huge disservice that is done to them. And I think it is something that does need to be addressed. The tactics that they use and have used over the last year are reminiscent of the activists that were used by the ACT UP folks years ago during the AIDS crisis. So it's a tried and true protest, and it's something that, is really, I think, engineered just to make people sit up and realize that, these are issues that do need to be addressed. There are not a terrific amount of folks, and I'm calling out you, Human Rights Campaign, and you, GLAAD, and you, Task Force, that seem interested in, addressing the issues, of concern, especially when you consider how many trans women of color have been murdered. Even this year alone, the body count is up again. It seems like every time. Kansas City just reported over the weekend yet a second murder of a trans woman of color. So, it's a pandemic, and I think in a lot of ways the community itself is at fault, for not recognizing and giving them, letting them hear and letting them voice, what they need to. Although, it's...
Okay, but when you say that community is at fault, that seems like a stretch to me that the community is at fault.
The activist part of the community. I'm talking about the movers and shakers in the community. Okay. Gay Inc. All right.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of a little bit over glitz and glamour going on in the Gay Inc. realm. But what would the picture look like if they were doing what is suggested?
I think what would look different, at least as far as the optics would go, is they really need to sit down and really work in the local communities where these problems are occurring, and they need to have more of a national focus on this, and they have not done that. There's a lot of outrage. We hear it every time another Black trans woman of color, Latino, or Latinx is murdered, but it just seems to drop by the wayside. And I think that what they're asking for is that there's, more of a focus on it, and that more people are made aware of just how bad it actually is. And it's a divide, but it's. I don't think it's a divide that's insurmountable. I just think it's a divide, that needs to be bridged. Unfortunately, over the Stonewall celebrations, It that conversation got toxic in terms of Stonewall's actual legacy. In specific, you know, the role that was played that night and for the next 3 days on Christopher Street. So, you know, there is a certain amount of folks talking past each other. And I think in many ways, you know, that needs to stop.
Yeah, and I actually have heard narratives both ways about what transpired, you know, exactly that night at Stonewall Inn. And I actually was at Stonewall Inn now it's probably about a decade ago and talked to one of the bartenders who was actually there. And, I mean, it was chaotic that night, so it's trying to attribute the sequence of events is difficult anyway, because it, you know, it's like trying to track the internal things of an explosion. You know, where did the sparks happen? You know, I mean, it's, you know, a little bit backwards, but whereas, you know, the original narrative kind of whitewashed it, the most recent narrative sort of has credited a couple of transgender individuals of you know, picking up arms and creating the whole thing, when it's actually documented that neither one of them was actually physically there at the very beginning. You know, so it's sort of this every story has got kind of a little bit of fabrication, you know, weaved into it. And I certainly support the idea that we need to be focusing in on these areas of oppression, which I think are larger than what any advocacy organization is going to be able to do on their own. I mean, these murders are happening in areas where the culture literally is inspiring it. And that takes a huge change of ridding the mindset out of homophobia and transphobia out of the population in those areas. And nothing's being said of the health services in those areas, which are allowing people of color to suffer under AIDS, where there are now medications and procedures that should be happening that could save lives. I mean, that's being ignored as well. So it's not just a transgender only issue. The one thing that I guess doesn't bother me, I don't mind that, you know, people get all wax nostalgic about the old days of a stripped down protest march. I find it a little bit myopic on the part of younger people, where they're not appreciating how the effect of that bigger parade and the involvement of the establishment in it is a win. It is what, you know, being old enough to know what those original protest marches were and felt like, you know, that was exactly what the issue was that businesses and the culture of America was ignoring the LGBT community altogether, and we were suffering as a result. And I also think that we need to acknowledge that many of the gains and many of the clout we have, you know, when they pass these horrible transgender bathroom bills and different threats to our human rights around the country, the ones who cause an effect, who make it change, are these corporations who go into these states and say, if you are not going to respect human rights of all people, we're pulling out of here. We're taking our dollars and walking. And so there's a huge value, in my opinion, to that corporate level of outreach that benefits everyone. And, you know, so it's like just trying to strip it all down to back to the old days of the downtrodden, you know, bare bones march, to me is naive.
Well, on that point, I can actually segue into the Supreme Court based on what you just said.
Okay. And speaking of...
speaking of SCOTUS, U.S. Supreme Court designated October 8th as the date it will hear arguments on whether Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 applies to cases of anti-LGBTQ discrimination. Now, this will set up a showdown for when LGBT rights in all areas of life will be held in the balance. Those words written a few days ago by Washington Blade White House reporter Chris Johnson. He's right. Interestingly enough, so far, a total of 206 of those very companies you were just mentioning have signed on to amicus briefs urging the high court, okay, to find that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act does, in fact, bar discrimination against LGBTQ people in the workforce. Now, the friend of the court brief or the amicus brief, and there's a ton of them. We haven't seen, I don't think, this many of them since Windsor versus U.S. or Obergefell versus U.S., the two marriage equality decisions. Virtually every trans legal organization, every LGBTQ organization, equality organizations, federations, you know, major corporations, which include, you know, General Motors, Comcast Universal, the Walt Disney Company, Facebook itself, Northrop Grumman, and Apple, among others. This is a big deal. It is one of the things where these briefs that are being signed by all these companies and by these organizations, you know, are trying to make sure that the court understands, okay, just how dire this particular thing would be. And I'm going to quote from the front of the court brief, and this is put out by the Human Rights Campaign, Lambda Legal, Out and Equal, and Freedom for All Americans. And here's the quote. Even where companies voluntarily implement policies to prohibit sexual orientation or gender identity discrimination, such policies are not a substitute for the force of law, nor is the patchwork of incomplete state or local laws sufficient protection, for example. They cannot account for the cross-state mobility requirements of the modern workforce. Only a uniform federal rule can enable businesses to recruit and retain and employees to perform at their highest levels. The main thrust here is that in the era of the Trump administration, where we have seen back, we've seen rollbacks just constantly of LGBTQ protections and rights, with trans military ban, you know, the ranging from the very petty over no display of the pride flag at U.S. embassies and missions abroad to, you know, statements made by the administration in regards to, you know, trans people in general. This is a critical decision. This is really seriously, you know, important. The American Civil Liberties Union has also, you know, weighed in on this, along with a couple of other of the civil rights and human rights groups. One of the points that they're making, okay, is that if the court can't find that that interpretation, okay, is covered, then that's just going to wipe everything across the board. And what's especially troubling, okay, in terms of court precedents, if that happens, according to some of the legal experts I've spoken to in the last week or so, because of what Judge Clarence Thomas wrote in another opinion that specifically singled out Obergefell versus U.S., okay, that would open the door for a challenge to marriage equality back to the court. Now, you know, that's not to say the court would necessarily hear it, but then it can, the court is hearing things that nobody expected them to hear, and as a direct result, that challenge could come up. And so
Can you explain, Brody, can you explain that a little more thoroughly, why this would somehow track back to marriage equality?
Well, all right. The problem with the way that the court operates is that once law has been established or precedence has been established, that's generally the rule that the court, you know, falls along with, okay? But it's all based on interpretation of the law, okay? Thomas last month argued in a decision, okay, that respecting legal precedents, which is known by the legal term citare decisis, shouldn't be sacred. In other words, okay, that just because the court rules a particular way doesn't mean that that's got to be sacred across the board. And then he directly pointed at Obergefell versus Hodges, okay, which was really the case that made marriage equality a national right, okay. Here's what the judge wrote. This is what Justice Thomas wrote. I write separately to address the proper role of the doctrine of citare decisis. In my view, the court's typical formulation of the citare decisis standard does not comport with our judicial duty under Article 3 because it elevates demonstrously erroneous decisions, meaning decisions outside the realm of permissible interpretation, over the text of the Constitution and other duly enacted federal law. Okay? So then he poked directly at Obergefell, okay? And I quote, "It is always tempting for judges to confuse our own preferences with the requirements of the law, Obergefell v. Hodges," cited Thomas, "and the court's citare decisis doctrine exasperates the temptation by giving the veneer of respectability to our continued application of demonstrably incorrect precedents." So what he's basically saying is that the decision that the court made in Obergefell was incorrect, okay, and wasn't constitutionally permissible. Now, why is this important? Because if they decide using those same principles to make a similar decision in this October case, okay, and it would leave the door open for essentially lawful discrimination against LGBTQ people, okay, because it's not a protected class, you can imagine where that one would go. And so this is why these companies, and this is why the activists and the activist attorneys are all fired up right now, based on this. Remember, you've got at least Thomas, Paliotto, and probably Kavanaugh. They're going to come down on the uber conservative side. Okay. The two wild cards in this are the Chief Justice of the United States and Justice Gorsuch. Gorsuch is known as a strict literalist, and so it's questionable which way he would go. But the overarching problem to this is you have the majority on the court. So the 5-4 ruling would basically kick it out the door. That's what's going
right.
to keep people concerned.
Well, here's, and let's be clear, because my understanding of the case is that the Title VII is about whether prohibitions against gender discrimination actually apply to sexual orientation, because in those situations it is not illogical to see that somebody of the different gender in the situation would dramatically affect what the outcome would be. In other words, the gender, sexual orientation, and gender positioning of the person are tied together. I guess I understand that, although it would seem that even if they say no, this is only talking about the gender of the person, and you cannot test, because, and this is where a literalist would probably come down, you can't just extrapolate that out to sexual orientation, even if it seems somewhat logical, you can't do that. So if they ruled that way, that would seemingly put that as a blank slate, meaning that states could then protect sexual orientation, but they would have to do it specifically. And I guess for me, I'm not seeing the leap of that, you know, to Thomas's comment directly. I mean, Thomas's comment, in a way, the one that comes to mind for me, although I'm sure it's not one that he was even thinking of at the time, is interpretations over the Second Amendment. Because to me, some of the rulings on that really were overriding what is literally said in the Second Amendment. And if you took the principles he's talking about, that could be challenged. So it seems like it could be a two-edged sword either way.
Yeah, you're referring to the decisions that were written by Justice Scalia. Yeah, it could be. But again, the whole thing is based on precedents and already established law and rulings and decisions, if they do that, okay? Yes. It all, again, it hinges off of whether or not, okay, you know, it comes down to the word intent. And then, of course, the other part of this is the fact that the Christian right and the conservatives are painting this as also as a religious, you know, freedom and liberty issue. You know, the base translation to that is, the Christians want the ability to discriminate against people they don't like, okay, which includes people who have abortions, gay people, transgender people, Muslims. Pick someone the Christians don't like. They want to be able to discriminate against them, okay? That's basically, if you strip the veneer of all the nasty and the nice and everything out of the way and all the BS, that's what you end up with. When you say religious freedom and religious liberties, you're talking about, okay, and not all Christians, obviously, but, you know, unfortunately, a good majority of them, you know, with painting the broad brush, okay, that's what they want to do. They want to have the right to discriminate. The thing of it is they've already been through that drill once before, and this is what the legal argument has been. If you look at the discriminatory practices of the Christians over, well, from the very beginning, against the slaves, against the Irish, against the Catholics, against the Chinese, against the Japanese, against African Americans, starting with lynchings going all the way through to what ultimately culminated with Loving v. Virginia on interracial marriage, it goes to the heart of their argument, okay? They can't walk around that, because every time they say religious freedom, someone's going to drag that out in a legalistic way and say, well, yeah, you guys, you know, legally discriminate against, you know, actually this very, you know, act, the Civil Rights Act itself, you know, because you guys were all about, you know, discriminatory practices, and, you know, you guys are all about things like that. So it's like, yeah, no, you can't be saying that. The question is whether the legal bar will be set for that. So we know where they're going to argue, and we know the point that they're going to argue, but we're just not sure how far they're going to take it. That's all. And of course, the other part of it,
well, the,
you know, is what the court decides.
Well, the other side of it, though, is what you were talking about before, though, with the amicus briefs, because here's what's going to happen with corporate America, where this is a big problem for them, and why. I mean, you know, I'd love to think that corporate America was just jumping in on this because, you know, gosh darn it, they just love LGBTQ people, which they kind of do. I mean, it's like they, you know, LGBTQ people tend to be the out-of-box thinkers, and so there is this almost cultural value that, you know, and I'm way overgeneralizing now, but a lot of LGBTQ people in business and in those disciplines bring, and corporations know that. I mean, they, you know, it's like you look at Apple and, you know, and a lot of technology, they need the cutting edge thinkers and people who look to go beyond the norms. So, you know, that mindset is valuable. But, you know, and I can share from my own perspective, having worked in corporate America when there were not protections across the country, but California did place non-discrimination protections here. What happens for those of us who work in big business is we suddenly go under house arrest, because what that means is if we have a job in Silicon Valley where we're not going to be discriminated against, we can be ourselves, we have, we're treated equally to our fellow workers, we're comfortable. But the company we're working for decides that it is going to open up a new center in Utah, and it wants to have people relocate there and continue their careers, many people all of a sudden would go, I'm out. I'm not going. I won't be protected there. I could go into a department there where a religious zealot is in charge of the department who chooses to fire me simply for who I am, or discriminate against me and make life miserable without any ramifications on my part to deal with that. And so that puts a conundrum for these corporate entities who are looking to expand in areas where in America that it is more economically feasible to put parts of their company, but then they can't have it where literally they would lose, people in their organization that know how the organization runs, because those people are afraid to go work and be susceptible in those areas. And so there is their threats to pull out of these places are not just because of moral outrage. It is they understand that it creates an enormous economic problem for them to, discrimination is not cost-free. It costs a company to have discrimination, whether it's ordained or whether it is illegal. It will cost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another factor in this.
I don't disagree. Like I said, I think the important thing, though, is the fact that there are now enough U.S. corporations and companies that I think recognize that fact and are willing to fight it. It's just unfortunate that, here we are some 50 years and then plus from, when the Civil Rights Act was actually signed into law, and we're still having these fights today. So it's one of the things that's just, it's unfortunate, I think, overall. But, with everything
The thing is, though, mm-hmm. I think it's really peeling the onion. I mean, I think a lot of these things, when they were enacted, the idea that they suddenly changed the whole world around them is unrealistic. I mean, it's like when the Civil Rights Act came through, it was specific, and there was plenty of the population that then took their grievances and animosity towards it underground, which we've certainly seen just in race with the Trump administration. Trump didn't create the bigotry that's come out. He just unleashed it from where it was hiding, but it was still there. But the same thing with some of the big gains. I mean, marriage equality for the United States, the vast majority of states in the United States were forced to accept marriage equality. They didn't sign up willingly. They didn't drop their, they had a sweep of elections that the population in these states, basically flipped the bird to the LGBT community and said, you can't have what we do. You don't get to orchestrate your lives like we do. And the court mandated that changed. Now, the election right before that, though, we had our very first population gains in three states where the states did rule, did support it. So the tide was already turning, but to think that ruling just simply erased
everybody who is against us is unrealistic. So I just see these as new battles, but they're necessary. They're necessary that we walk through this. My opinion.
Well, I agree. I'm not saying that they changed. They weren't obviously game changers at the time. It's been a path forward of progress. I just find it disconcerting that, you know, you would think at a certain point there would be a better amount of progress, and there's not. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the concepts are always bigger and better and there before the reality catch up, and we just gotta, you know, carry the rest of it with us, you know, as part of the momentum mm-hmm. that we need. You know, I mean, it would obviously help if we had a more philosophically supportive Supreme Court, which, you know, is somewhat of a challenge, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well,
so
we are looking.
Then we
at,
have Trump. Yeah. No,
God,
then we have Trump.
Trump
speaking of philosophical, so he is rolling out a new human rights committee. What can you tell us about that?
The State Department is rolling out this new Commission on Human Rights based on natural law. And of course, that term has been a trigger term in terms of automatically ruling out women's reproductive rights and the LGBTQ community in general. And again, it's steeped in the so-called Judeo-Christian ethos, and the influence is coming from the Christian right in particular. One of the people who is going to be involved in that, of course, is unfortunately right-wing activist Tony Perkins, who happens to be chair of the president's new Religious Freedom Commission. This is a person who has said that, you know, gay conversion therapy should be, you know, used on gay people because it works. And, you know, he's also made statements that Islam, the religion, was incompatible with the U.S. Constitution. The State Department hasn't really truly defined just yet what this new commission will do. However, we've been kind of looking at it to see, you know, some of the areas that it could cover, and it is kind of problematic. Only because of the fact that, you know, it's, if you do this on a more global basis and you're supporting certain regimes, you know, you're actually undercutting women's rights and LGBTQ rights. And this is of a concern. Now, we're expecting the launch on it fairly soon. So I think what we're going to be seeing with this, and this is really where the problem lies, is, you know, the interpretation. Of course, Secretary Pompeo is a, you know, former Tea Party type. He's been a longtime supporter of the evangelical right. The actual name of this will be the Commission on Unalienable Rights. Okay. They've chosen 10 people so far. The problem with this is that this panel had virtually no input internally from the State Department's old Human Rights Bureau itself. You know, these are career bureaucrats and career foreign service people that are extremely familiar with this, and they have extensive backgrounds in history on human rights policy, okay, across numerous administrations. And what's happened is that Pompeo just walked right by them. Okay. Now, a State Department spokesperson told us in the media that the panel is advisory and will not create policy. However, you know, the problem with that is that kind of vague statement always inevitably ends up working its way into, they actually at some point do implement policy by suggestion or by whatever else. This thing is also not earning any fans with the United Nations. Of course, the United States has pulled back from almost all of the of that international body's human rights boards and councils, and so this is once again another in a long list of the Trump administration thumbing its nose and going its own way, and predicated on some pretty deeply flawed, thinking. So this is, it's already raising eyebrows, in terms of, the committees of the Congress, the U.S. House, the Democrats in particular, aren't happy with this. One of the things that, is everybody's questioning is whether or not it will follow with the 1948 UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was one of probably the most keynote documents signed by that international body and has been a guiding force to U.S. policy for years and years and years, up until we get to the Trump administration. So that's kind of the, using the vague terms natural law and natural rights, these are terms that, have always led to arguments used by religious opponents of same-sex marriage and abortion rights. And so that's kind of where we're at with that.
Brody, let me ask you, one of the things that the Trump administration has actually come out championing around the world is decriminalization of homosexuality in countries where the criminalization of it has had dire effects. And obviously there's a little bit of method to their madness in that if they stand up for something that is just completely outrageous anyway, then they can claim to be pro-LGBT when they're just simply being, kind of drawing a simple line on decency and not really standing up for some of the more specific oversights of LGBTQ lives. But where do you think that policy will stand in the advice of this new potential commission, especially when some of the characterizations, I don't know if it's the exact people, but a lot of the broader reach of the Tony Perkins ilk have been people who've gone over into these countries to basically prop up criminalization. How do you think that will play out?
Well, this is a concern. And I'm going to quote Senator Robert Menendez, who's a ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. This is what Senator Menendez said. Congress has a responsibility to ensure the United States continues to stand as a principled bulwark in defense of human rights and the rule of law. That includes robust oversight to ensure this new commission is not used as another platform for the Trump administration to further erode U.S. leadership on human rights across the board. And what the senator from New Jersey is making a point of, if you look at human rights violations, even by American allies like the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians and the North Koreans, it becomes relatively obvious that there's a disconnect there. With the Israelis, of course, it's the generally the Palestinian issues. And there's been a lot of criticism of Israel and that it's more or less a kind of a different form of apartheid. With the Saudis, of course, it's the gay rights, it's the women's rights, it's just human rights in general, not to mention the fact that, most fingers point at them as being directly responsible for the murder of journalist Kanogi. So, you know, it just, this is some of the things. It's like every Khashoggi, I'm sorry, not Kanogi, Khashoggi, I was mispronounced his name, that, you know, it's like talking out of both sides of the mouth. And I think that the senator from New Jersey is correct. And, of course, the other thing that becomes very problematic with this is not just, you know, LGBTQ rights, but also the rights of, you know, women in terms of the reproductive and general women's rights altogether. So there is
big
alarm for this. Yeah, big time. So there's good reason to be a little alarmed at this one. And particularly when you have people being mentioned, you know, to possibly serve on it, including Tony Perkins. I mean, that's alarm bells are going off all over the place. You know, Tony Perkins is probably one of the last people I'd ever want to see sitting on a human rights commission, ever. You know, so
yeah, it's sort of counterintuitive to much ever getting accomplished there. But then, you know, that's sort of Trump's pattern. He seemed to be adamant in his construction of his whole administration to put people in positions of agencies and disciplines that they were essentially not just counterproductive, but philosophically opposed to, from Rick Perry to Betsy DeVos to, you know, you name it. They seem to be set up to go in to break it rather than to improve it. This seems almost typical. Brody, I want to ask you one other thing, though, because we're winding down our time here.
Okay.
There, as I understand it, and I don't have all the information, I'm sure you do, there seems to be a new member of the communications team in the Trump administration who is gay, but who is also anti-trans. Can you tell me about this individual and what they're doing?
This person has raised a tremendous amount of angst and with good reason. My colleague at BuzzFeed, Dominic Holden, profiled him. It's President Trump's new deputy press secretary, Judd Deere. And he has more or less held up, you know, every anti-trans, anti-LGBT thing that the administration has done. And he does it in such a way, it's extremely, you know, disingenuous. He told Dominic that, and I'm quoting Dom's article, "These individuals that I work with in this building don't treat me any differently because I'm gay." Okay. But the problem is, you know, this is a guy who's previously served as a spokesperson for the Arkansas Attorney General's office. Okay. When that office asked the court to block same-sex parents, from, you know, being listed on a child's birth certificate. Well, and also he was a spokesperson for the Attorney General's office when, you know, the Supreme Court was asked to strike down the city of Fayetteville, Arkansas's LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance. You know, the problem with him is that he just doesn't carry the water on LGBTQ issues, and it really becomes, it all revolves around this. Like, and many of these gay Republicans, it's the same thing. None of the president's stances are actually discriminatory. Okay, you know, this guy believes, for example, and Dominic wrote this, the transgender military ban. The answer, it's a matter of troop combat readiness. Okay? The next issue, policies to protect religious health care workers who deny services. Okay. Well, his answer is that merely preserves conscious rights. Okay. All right. Then he was asked, arguing that a Christian baker can refuse a wedding cake to a gay couple. Okay. Here was his answer. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. I would just go find another cake shop that would do it. And of course, you know, Dom's piece was pretty straightforward and painted the picture of this guy as, you know, another, you know, wealthy white gay guy, Republican, quite frankly, at the end of the day, who's got his head up his posterior. Okay. Which, you know, you and I've talked about this many times before, on air and off air. I don't get gay Republicans. I just don't. It's, you know, I get that the community is diverse and that they're part of the community, but they literally are all about working with people who would deny them rights if they could get away with it and they're okay with it. And I, to this day, I still don't get that. It just doesn't make any sense at all whatsoever. And this guy, unfortunately, because he's in the position of being the deputy White House press secretary, means that he is the spokesperson for Trump and all of the evil crap that comes flowing out of that building when it comes down to LGBTQ. And that's really probably the most bothersome thing to me about that. Okay. So, you know, he's one of the people that, you know, you almost want to use the throwback term, you know, President Trump's homosexual spokesperson. Okay. I don't really want to use the word gay with this guy. I just don't. Homosexual, I'm good with.
Right.
Gay,
right.
Not so much.
Right. No, it's and his positioning there, I think is divisive, because I think that just further, and this may be part of the intent, it makes him a touch point for people who want to say, you know, gay and lesbian people don't care about transgender people, and look at what happens when one of them gets into power. This is what comes out. And with that, I'm afraid that will have to be our last word for today. Happy 4th of July. Happy Independence Day, everybody. That is the end of our program today. And as we said, this was recorded, so you can hear it earlier than our designated time, or you can listen to it tonight at 7 p.m. because it'll be sitting here ready and willing and ready for you to hear. We will be back again next week, Thursday, 7 p.m., our regular time, Pacific time, and that's 10 p.m. Eastern time. We thank you very much for listening. I want to thank Brody for his knowledge, expertise, and participation. And also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com. That's Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. And with that, we hope you have a fun, productive, and wonderful rest of the day.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.